This week, we've been hearing about fatigue among air traffic controllers who often work graveyard shifts. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has it that some 15% of Americans do shift work outside the standard 9-to-5. That's true of many of us here on Morning Edition, which makes us that much more curious about others on the night shift. A call out on Facebook got us more than 2,000 responses, and we called a few of them back.
My name's Colin Lowry. I live in Louisville, Kentucky. I found this really great internship doing computer troubleshooting work.
My name is Tina Nguyen, and I am a family medicine physician who is currently in the military. I am a captain.
My name is Paris Huang. I am an international broadcaster of Voice of America's Chinese service. We have to match to the Asian's prime news time.
My name is Alan Inestrosa. I'm a truck driver for a road construction crew. Sometimes we work night shifts, sometimes we work day shifts.
In the daytime, you know, you always have like a professional environment, but in late shifts, you can be more yourself.
We've got a pretty good crew at night, so we keep each other awake by playing games. One of our techs actually brings in his Xbox, and we play You Don't Know Jack.
You would seem that when you get home, it'd be really easy to fall asleep, but it's not always the case anyways, because it's morning, you know, the light's coming in. So when I get home, I probably don't even fall asleep till about 3 or 4 hours after my shift.
I used to try to drink some alcohol, like red wine or something, that could help me fall asleep, but I figure out it's not really healthy that way. And I tried to take pills.
I'm against that. Sleep comes naturally to me, I guess. I don't understand people that need to take nighttime aids. Besides, if you see those commercials, they've got some side effects, like nighttime wackiness.
Being a 19-year-old kid in college, you know, people expect you to go to parties, things like that. Hey, Colin, you want to go to a party on Saturday? Nope, sorry, I have to work all night. Luckily, I found some friends who have the same schedule as I do, and we basically just hang out in the wee morning hours, and it's about the only interaction you get.
I have difficulty staying asleep sometimes, because just because you're on the night schedule, your kids aren't on that same schedule, and when they say, hey, Dad, come on and color with me, can't really tell them no. That's the reason I do what I do, is for love of my family.
When I wake up early in the morning,
late shift workers Alan Inestrosa, Colin Lowry, Paris Huang, and Tina Nguyen. They were just a few of the 2,000 listeners who wrote us on Facebook. You can read more at the NPR Facebook page and read an essay by one of our own producers about his experiences overnight. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
Joining us now to talk about politics are our regular weekly guest, columnist David Brooks of the New York Times. Welcome, David.
Good to be here.
And sitting in for E.J. Dionne this week, Cynthia Tucker, columnist and blogger for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi again.
Good to see you.
And I'd like to start with Libya, where, as we just heard, John McCain made a visit today. The U.S. is now supplying drones, pilotless aircraft, that is, to the Libyan rebels, ostensibly to better protect civilian lives there. Is Washington guided by some clear policy in the Libyan crisis, or just improvising? And if their policy is guiding us, do they apply elsewhere, say, to Libya, to Syria? David Brooks, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a policy. It doesn't have to do with the rebels so much. My conversations with the people in the administration are emphasize less what they call the defeat track, that the opposition would actually win, than the defection track, that people around Gaddafi would actually begin to defect. And that's where I think the drones are interesting. They're a tough call because on the one hand, using drones in Libya, drones are really hated in the region. They're seen as a sign of imperial U.S. arrogance. On the other hand, if you can threaten people around Gaddafi with the threat of really assassination, which is really what it's all about, maybe you can weaken the regime. Maybe they do act to depose Gaddafi. So I think the defection track is the more likely, and I do think there's a strategy. We don't know if it'll work, of course.
And you're saying the point about the drones is they can be targeted at a very, very specific, narrow
right. So if you're a Gaddafi lieutenant, you have to worry.
Cynthia, what do you think about this?
I worry about mission creep. I worry that the drones do represent just what David said, a symbol of U.S. arrogance, which is the last thing we need more of in the Arab world. I worry about the money that we're spending at a time when many Americans are being told that there's not enough money for Medicaid, not enough money for unemployment benefits for the unemployed, not enough money to preserve Head Start classes. And I worry about the end game here. Because I think that there will be constant pressure on the Obama administration to avoid what is being called a stalemate. You heard John McCain saying we need more American involvement. If Gaddafi doesn't leave quickly in the next couple of months, then what? I think that there will be constant pressure on the Obama administration to put more material, certainly, and more advisors on the ground as well.
The McCain message there was pretty clear. These guys are my heroes. We should recognize them right away as the Libyan government.
I thought that was it was certainly well received among the rebel fighters, but the fact of the matter is we don't know who these forces are. I don't have any great fear that they are necessarily a whole lot of al-Qaeda sympathizers, but they're disorganized. There's a lot of infighting here at the top, and there is absolutely nothing to suggest that this is a bunch of Jeffersonian Democrats.
Let's move on to the economy. And now, the New York Times reports finding in the latest Times CBS News public opinion poll, and I quote, "What appears to be an abrupt change in attitude, the number of Americans who think the economy is getting worse has jumped 13 percentage points in just 1 month." David Brooks, what's happening?
Yeah, and I think that followed a couple months previously of a sharp drop. So in the last 3-4 months, I think we've seen a drop in economic confidence. A lot of that has to do with gas prices. Gas prices are very powerful predictors. Other things have to do with just the lagging economy. And I think there's a political element here. I think the fact that people look at politics, as the S&P analyst did this week, and said, we really don't see a way out of this, that I think that deepens the gloom, especially at a time, and I think this is underlying all our politics, when roughly 65% of Americans think we're in decline. So there's just a layer upon layer of gloom.
A message for Washington, Cynthia Tucker?
There is a message for Washington. I agree with David that gas prices have a lot to do with the current feeling that the economy is getting worse. But I also do think that Americans see a dysfunctional Washington, incapable of coming together to solve big problems. And politicians who talk about issues that are not the issues that people are talking about over their kitchen tables, necessarily.
I mean, like gas prices, for example.
Gas prices being an excellent example, but also deficit reduction. People understand that we have a major problem 10, 20 years out. But while we're worried about that, there are Americans saying, well, you know, the country could go bankrupt in 20 years. I could go bankrupt next week.
Yeah, I also think they sense the structure of the debate hasn't changed. Democrats are sounding very much like Democrats, Republicans very much like Republicans. The debate is in its stagnant World War I trench warfare mode. and I think the president really wanted to and maybe could have really changed the underlying structure of the debate, and that hasn't happened.
And the decline in approval is not just for the president, who's dipped a little bit in the past few weeks, but Republicans in Congress as well, according to this poll.
Right. All institutions are really suffering. The president is sort of hovering. It's interesting. His economic policies are really unpopular. He's a little more popular than they are. Republicans are about in Congress. Congress has always been terrible, and it remains terrible. And so people don't have a sense that we have something. You know, I was in New York after the crime rate fell, and people had a sense, oh, yeah, the city is actually governable. I don't think people have that sense nationally right now.
Here was a finding in that New York Times CBS News poll. People were asked about raising taxes on those who make over $250,000 a year, that is, ending the Bush tax cuts for the well-to-do. The number who said, yeah, you should do that to help ease the deficit is 72%. That is not an insignificant number, but can Republicans in Washington just ignore that?
Well, so far, it seems that they are. And while there's plenty of blame to go around here, one of the reasons that the deficit debate hasn't moved at all is because most Republicans have absolutely taken increasing taxes off the table. It is hard to see how we move from where we are, how we get the deficit under control, if you say no taxes are raised ever on anyone. And it is another sign of dysfunction, I think.
Yeah, though I would blame the American people a little here. I mean, they want to see other people pay to balance the budget. Well, the poll today underlines once again they don't want to have any pain for themselves. And so cutting defense is popular, raising taxes on the rich is popular, everything else is unpopular. And unfortunately, we really can't make much headway without doing that other stuff.
And changing Medicare is sort of popular or sort of unpopular.
No, well, I think it's pretty unpopular. I mean, that's there is no education process that's been done by people in Washington or anywhere else to educate the American people about what needs to be done.
Okay, well, have a good weekend.
You too.
Both of you, David Brooks and Cynthia Tucker. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The new film, Incendie, is set largely in the Middle East, and it has the structure of an old-fashioned mystery. In French, the title means fire, conflagration, blaze. And Bob Mondello says that's fitting because the film burns hotter than most.
Near the beginning of Incendie, a notary in Canada reads a mother's will to her two grown children, twins Simon and Jean.
Enterrez-moi sans cercueil, nu et sans prière.
In the will, Nawal Marwan specifies that she is to be buried without a coffin or headstone, naked and face down, because those who don't keep their promises don't deserve to face the world. Then the notary hands the twins two envelopes that the will specifies must be delivered to their father and their brother. Once that's done, their mother's promise will have been kept, and they can place a headstone on her grave. The problem? As far as the twins know, their father died decades earlier, half a world away. And they don't have a brother. So begins an odyssey that immerses Simon and Jean deep in a Middle Eastern past that their mother, played searingly by Lubna Azabal, never talked about, a past in which she bore a child out of wedlock, her disgrace catching her family up in a bloody chain of violence and retribution, militant Christians and Muslims slaughtering each other in an unending cycle of revenge for past murders. The country isn't specified, but it's pretty clearly Lebanon, from which playwright Wajdi Muawad and his family fled when he was a child. Incendie is based on his play Scorched, though until its final moments there's barely a hint that it came from the stage. Where the play is crammed with long paragraphs of dialogue, Denis Villeneuve's film makes its most trenchant points with silence, gasps, wails, his camera panning across brutal landscapes as characters have their lives upended by newly discovered truths. I can't recall seeing a film in which I have so often wondered, my God, how must that feel? At least partly because we in the audience are meant to be as unsettled as the characters. A few critics have argued that the ending is over the top, and I suppose if you're a literalist, it is. But the storytelling in Incendie strikes me as primal the way Greek tragedy is primal, shattering, cathartic. It is, no matter how you feel about the ending, a breathtaking film. I'm Bob Mondello.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week, and is it shuttle related?
It is. We're celebrating space travel with the video pick this week. It's actually three picks. It's a triple header.
It's a film festival.
Yes, it's a space film festival, basically. Let me run down what we have on the ticket.
Okay.
You. Okay, so we have some golden oldies, including fan favorites, Water Balloons in Space,
that's the most viewed one, isn't it?
It's the most viewed, and it's because these two scientists, these two engineers, just seemed like they were having a great time popping water balloons in NASA's low-gravity aircraft. So
getting
that's
very wet. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Mm-hmm. And?
The next one is Candy Corn in Space.
Love it.
Apparently, you can use a ball of wet candy corn to demonstrate some science if you are as innovative as John Pettit, an astronaut who we've talked to on the show. And our newest addition to our space lineup is one that features one of our last guests, Jeff Hoffman, the astronaut who was just on. And this is an astronaut in space. And he went on a spacewalk on his first mission up and really had some moving words, I thought, about what that experience was like. So you can actually see him fixing a satellite.
Mm-hmm. He's very, as you can hear, he's very articulate, but also he liked to play games in space too, didn't he?
That's true. And this is he brought up a slinky and a little toy car, and I think his favorite, he said, was the yo-yo. So can you guess what a yo-yo does in zero G? I couldn't, but you can see the answer.
He said
some physicists were sort of had vigorous debate about this until he actually did the experiment.
How would a yo-yo work in space?
Yeah, so you can find out. I mean, that was the thing.
Yeah.
You started the hour talking about the right stuff, and it seems from these videos anyway that this sort of intense curiosity must be part of being an astronaut because...
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the video, it's up there on our website on our video pick of the week. It's a trifecta. It's a... It's a film festival of space science, so to speak.
Yes, it is. And we have one more announcement. Speaking of NASA video, NASA, in honor of Earth Day, has a video contest that they've launched today, and I think it's open until May 27th. But you can get all the details about this video contest. They're looking for your videos, 2 minutes about why the Earth is inspiring, and you can get the details through a link on our website or go to NASA.gov.
A NASA video contest.
Yeah.
Wow.
So maybe that's a good way to celebrate Earth Day today.
Earth Day today. And so you go to our website, a video pick of the week, you see the trifecta videos. And what happens to – what we're not going to tell you. What happens to a yo-yo in space when you use it? You also get to relive the water balloon, which is fantastic.
And
candy corn. How do you lock candy corn together into the – candy corn fits so magically together into a cute little ball.
It's like a Roman arc, apparently.
And it mimics a water and soap molecule,
that's
right?
That's it. That's what Don Pettit used it for, to show how soap works.
So this weekend and tonight, and you've got some great video movie – Friday night video movie pleasure.
Yeah, I think that adds up to like 9 minutes of your evening, but you could just watch them over and over again.
Then you get the NASA contest, the video contest. Knock yourself out.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Sarah.
That's our video pick of the week. It's up on our website at sciencefriday.com up there in the left-hand corner, and it'll also be available on iTunes up there on if you want to podcast it, and you can go to our website and podcast all that kind of good stuff there also, and become a member and subscribe, and you'll get them downloaded for you without having to worry about it. Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata, Catherine Wells, Leshu Bayak. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and assisting at the controls today is Manoli Weatherall. Our intern is Sam Flato. And if you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video. You get they'll download that video right onto your portable mobile device, either your iPod or your Android. And you can watch and take Science Friday with you the rest of the week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
Spring is normally one of the sweetest seasons for the candy industry, but there's anxiety in the air this Easter. The country's biggest chocolate maker is raising prices for the first time in years. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Pure joy. Pure delicious chocolate. Pure Hershey's.
Pretty soon, all that purity is going to cost you a little bit more. Hershey's is raising wholesale prices for most of its products by nearly 10%. Larry Graham is the president of the National Confectioners Association. He says rising commodity prices are squeezing the entire industry.
Cocoa prices are through the roof. Sugar is through the roof. Even milk and nuts are high. So there's been a lot of pressure on manufacturers to get their candy out and still make a profit.
The reasons for rising commodity prices vary, from a dismal peanut crop to a civil war in cocoa-rich Ivory Coast. When Hershey's officials announced the wholesale price hike last month, they promised that chocolate Easter bunnies won't cost any more this year. Retail prices aren't expected to rise for months. And even then, Morningstar analyst Aaron Lash says most people probably won't change their behavior much.
They might go from a king-size bar down to a standard-size bar, for example, but they won't necessarily trade out of the brand or the category.
If the past is any guide, Lash says other chocolate makers are likely to follow Hershey's lead and raise their prices, too. Joel Rose, NPR News, Philadelphia.
This April, National Poetry Month brings an ambitious collaboration. 54 poets writing an American Renga. A Renga is an ancient Japanese tradition where one poet hands off to another, a kind of poetic relay race. Here's poet Carol Muskie Dukes, who is one of the editors of the book that emerged called Crossing State Lines.
We called on the poets to do almost the impossible, which is to write 10 lines in less than 2 days. 10 lines doesn't sound like much, but if you're a poet, it's quite an assignment. And one other aspect of the Renga is that it's a conversation poem. So the poets were in conversation with each other, and a line that Michael Ryan, for example, making a riff on a joke, how many poets does it take to change a light bulb, and ends with how many poets does it take to change a country, how many presidents, how much pain. The wonderful poet Brenda Hillman picks up on that with, and a light bulb turns earth, Berkeley lovers in a Thai cafe, mint, sweet basil, Gemini showers all this week, solstice, almost. You can take money out of the empire, but you can't take the empire. Look, enough of these wars. A rabbit crouches in the moon.
Well, to hear more of this grand American Renga, we brought in two other poets who contributed lines, former poet laureate Robert Haas and Army Lieutenant Colonel Edward Ledford. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you.
So we have you all collected, but let me start by turning to Carol Muskie Dukes. So why don't you read us your poem? And the key thought in the previous poem was foreclosure. Although, read the line in the previous poem that speaks of foreclosure.
The line from the previous poem by Sohir Hamad is, "Pray a house is not a home," in response to the idea of foreclosure. And so I picked up that line in mind. Pray a house is not a home, and while you're at it, pray that prayer is not a funhouse mirror slid between terror and God's face. Time to make something from nothing. Garden, star chart, beehive, birdhouse, abacus, to add up what remains when what we thought was wealth is gone.
And that is how it goes throughout this American Renga. The poets touch down, zigzag, take two steps forward and one back, each taking up the challenge poet Robert Pinsky poses in these first lines. Beginning of October, maples kindle in the east, linked to fire season in the west, by what? For some, it is nature, birdsong, ascendant notes. Others speak of love. Every love is a drive toward a more perfect union. Still others speak of war. Ed Ledford brings this long poem nearly to its close. He served in war as an army officer. For him, that cross-continental connection is a moment of violence where only words survive. Ed Ledford, you're a lieutenant colonel in the Army.
Yes.
Where did you look for inspiration?
I had actually been in the Pentagon when the plane hit, so this had been something that I had thought about a lot. Right where the Pentagon had sheared off, on about the third floor is a dictionary on a pedestal, still open, apparently untouched, and I always thought that had a lot of symbolism.
Read your poem for us, please.
Okay. Pathogens injected Trojan horse style. Temple walls crumble before a small lexicon, altered and stable, unsullied, too briefly a miracle. Our neo-tragedy was their crazy carte blanche. You'd think they'd have read their Homer. But like slapping the moron beside the bully, we invade Babylon to applause, which muted throats cleared for political posterity. Soldiers are nothing more than pharmacon, charged with the damned duty, enlisted to oaths that only finally matter when we wish they didn't. The soldier philosopher turns the gun on himself to salvage some meaning. A smirk and crooked smile. Sure showed him, didn't we, Deadeye?
That, Ed, it's so dark, that poem. It's remarkable.
Bob Haas, you did end the Renga, which began in October, the fall. You ended in April. What did you pick out in that poem of Ed Ledford's that you were going to draw through as a thread?
One of the things Ed's poem reminded me of was this is a poem written in wartime. I didn't know I was coming at the end, but I knew that Robert's poem had maples in it falling.
And that would be Robert Pinsky.
And the Buddhist phrase that's used to describe the Renga is one word all mushed together that is swirling petals, falling leaves. That autumn is the same thing as spring. The seasons keep changing. So Robert's autumn gave me the spring, which it was when I was writing these lines. Oh, well, along the coast in greeny April, forgiveness is the blue sheen of lupin on a windy hillside, the grasses stating their case for and against the continent's violent requiem. The year turning as a Renga turns toward its source, rivery, many voiced, but what source, really, in the turning? So the hikers who have walked the cliff's edge unpack their lunches and gaze at the Pacific.
In the end, there is a forgiveness.
The earth forgives the previous year every year. On the other hand, the other phrase I picked up is from another poem, that is, the grasses stating their case for and against the continent's violent requiem. It's so hard to know how to think about American violence. And because we're at war, that violence was, runs through this poem. It was on every poet's mind. And partly it's been the job of American poets. I mean, I think Herman Melville said the job of American artists was to say no in thunder. So thinking about how we walk this earth with all the great things in its history and all the violent, terrible things in its history is where we come to always in thinking about this country.
Robert Haas is a former U.S. Poet Laureate. Carol Muskie Dukes is the current Poet Laureate of California. And Ed Ledford is a Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Army. They are among the 54 poets who contributed to Crossing State Lines and American Renga. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Steve Inskeep will be back on Monday. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.